People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. Now, I wonder if you, like me, are really quite obsessed with trains. Two things I love in life, train travel and traveling on ocean liners. And sadly, in this country, our railways not what it used to be, which is why I'm very keen to find out more about a book that I've recently read called On the Railway, in which David Williams shares the story of Africa's most extensive rail network, enriched with anecdotes from his own experiences as a railway child, a steward, and lifelong rail enthusiast. And he recounts tales of railway towns and his childhood in Estcourt, where the whistle of passing trains and the mighty steam locomotives were a daily part of his life. Now, you may well know David as a former deputy editor of the Financial Mail and deputy news editor and sports editor at Talk Radio 702, and also his executive experience includes a five-year stint as communications manager at SA Breweries. And he's also written several books, Rugby and Cricket featuring rather prominently. So, David, welcome. Welcome to Fine Music Radio.
Thanks, Rodney.
People of Note. I was fascinated with this book, and just there's so many questions I want to ask you. Time is always against us, but I just would like to know, first of all, why did you write it? What made you think, you know what, I must write a book about the railways in this country?
Well, I talk about my earliest memories, and which were very happy memories as a child, growing up in Estcourt, a town in the Midlands of KwaZulu-Natal, Natal as it was then. And one of my earliest, perhaps the earliest memory, was waking up and hearing the sound of steam engine shunting in the yard.
Which was loud.
Loud, and hammering away.
Yeah.
And we lived in a little railway house. And all over South Africa, there were these little villages known as spoorwegdorpe.
And they were next to the lines, literally.
Close to the line. So yeah. I had this spectacular set, if you like, the stage set. And the trains went backwards and forwards. And we lived about 50 meters. Our little house was 50 meters from the railway line.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, I don't put this in the book because I forgot it then, but I'm remembering now. My mother couldn't find me. I was four years old. She couldn't find me. I wasn't at school. It was too early for school. Couldn't find me. And eventually, a man who was building on a house down the road, he said, "Are you looking for your little boy?" She said, "Yes, where is he?" He said, "He's down by the railway line." And what I'd done was walk right down to the railway line. I was sitting a few feet away from the main Johannesburg-Durban railway line.
Good grief.
Watching these trains go past.
Yeah.
I don't remember doing this, but it must have been very strong attraction. And fascination with these trains. Mm. And as I got older, how they worked. And in particular, the steam engine, although not like some, I'm not a fanatic about steam engines, but they are so fascinating. They are like people. They eat, they drink, they breathe. They have a front and a back.
Yes.
They seem to have personalities. Whereas
You're so
diesel
right.
engines and electric engines, no one waves at diesels, but
no.
you wave at steam trains. They are so elemental.
And also majestic. Elemental and majestic.
I think the height of the railway steam engine globally was in the 1930s. It was before the diesels and electrics came in. So in America, in Europe, in South Africa, the great trains, Art Deco designs,
yes,
and so on.
Yes.
Magnificent locomotives, works of architecture as well as engineering.
And they work on a really quite simple system, don't they? Because I was at your book launch and you told the story of your grandfather or your father taking you a boil with a pot boiling on this.
Well, he saw me. I used to get up early, and I remember the sensation of my chin on the windowsill, the stone windowsill. The
probably
cold
quite cold
windowsill.
As well, as
yes,
you say.
Yes, cold, because I was only that high.
Yeah.
So I could stand with my chin on the windowsill. And he noticed this, and one day he took me to the kitchen where there was a coal stove. We didn't have an electric stove. So my mother had to get up early every morning and make the fire.
Yes.
And the fire was on, and he put one of those old-fashioned kettles, tin kettles, on the stove. And after a while, it simmered, and it began to boil. And the little lid started flapping and tapping and
yes.
jumping. And he said, "You see what's happening there?" And I watched, and he said, "If that lid was kept on, with no way of the steam getting out," I forget how he put it, but He said that kettle will explode. So the force of the steam is an enormous force, mm-hmm. and that's how the steam engine works.
And can you imagine the force of that steam on those engines, therefore, which must be huge?
Well, a big locomotive of the South African Railways would be about 100 tons.
Yes, yes.
And would pull a train of 700 to 800 tons, typically. And you've got this giant kettle, which is the boiler of the steam engine.
Yes.
And the engineers call it the expansionary property of steam. So you heat the water boils, and it expands and goes into the cylinders where it drives the pistons, which drive the wheels.
Yeah.
It's so simple. A four-year-old can understand immediately, and I did.
Did you?
How it works.
Yeah.
Don't ask me to explain an internal combustion engine, but I can explain a steam engine.
Okay. But the sheer power that steam, yeah. as we said, they're huge machines, those steam engines, mm-hmm. very heavy in their own right, mm-hmm. and they pulled all this weight. So the power, the pressure must be enormous.
That's right. And if you looked at the cylinder boxes mm-hmm. and the pistons, it's not that big an area taken up by them, but the force is enormous.
Yes.
And that's what created the Industrial Revolution. It's 200 years this year since the first proper train ran in England. And they're celebrating that 200th anniversary. Britain invented railways, and they changed the world. Ironically, in the rest of the world now, the age of the train is back. And in South Africa, it's not.
I know.
It's been a sad decline, but let's not talk about that yet.
Not yet, but I do want to get there, because you do get there in your book right towards the end of the sad decline. Mm. And I'd like to talk about that, but also I'm interested in what music you've chosen, David. Mm. What does a steam enthusiast choose? What is your first? Although I see you dipping into the world of opera, first
yes.
of all.
There's a lot of railway music, which I happen not to have chosen by different composers. But I grew up in quite a musical family. My mother used to run the choir in the church. She sang a lot. She was a soprano. My father was a pretty good baritone. And in those days, there was no television. There mm-hmm. was radio. And people would visit each other and get around the piano and sing on a Saturday evening for entertainment. And my mother used to sing some of the great arias from the opera, although she preferred West Side Story, My Fair Lady,
the musicals,
those ones.
Yes.
She loved singing those.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
she would accompany herself on the piano and play the piano very well. And then she would accompany my father when he sang, typically from the musicals of the 20s and 30s, as I say, a baritone, things like Old Man River.
Oh, yes.
And so on. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But I grew to love the soprano and the baritone in particular because I grew up with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't particularly musical in the sense of wanting to play an instrument, but I loved it. So there was always music around, and on the radio there was music. We had lots of records. And as I grew older, I became more exposed to the great operas. Now, I'm one of those who doesn't know much about opera, but I do know what I like.
That's important.
And I've grown to like certain singers, and I get interested in the debate about whether Maria Callas was really the greatest soprano ever. And you listen to her, and she has that almost glassy, fragile sound to it. It's almost too fragile. And some people will kill for that sound. I personally prefer someone like Kiri Takanawa, who I think has a deeper sound. But I'm talking, that's the limit of my knowledge of these things. But one of the great arias that I grew to love was One Fine Day from Madame Butterfly by
yes,
Puccini.
Yes.
And there are these composers, Puccini, Verdi to some extent, and there are three or four operas of each of them, and you get to know them, and you know what you like, and you like what you know, and you'll take any version of it. So One Fine Day seemed to me to be the perfect expression of what an opera or a soprano, and the sense of love and loss. And there was a book by Peter Conrad, I think, some years ago, I saw A Song of Love and Death. That's what opera is, A Song of Love and Death. And I suppose that's a pretty good description.
It's very good.
And
it's
One Fine Day is, Lieutenant Pinkerton, he departs.
That's right.
And she says one day he'll come back, and he doesn't.
Thank you. E come sarà giunto, chi dirà, chi dirà, chi amerà? Butterfly, la lontana, io senza la risposta me ne starò nascosta, un po' per ciglia e un po'
That beautiful aria from Puccini's opera Madame Butterfly, Un Bel Dì, One Fine Day, sung there by Kiri Takanoa, who, as you heard earlier, a favorite of my guest on People of Note this week, David Williams, whose book On the Railway, The Great South African Train Story, is why you're here, apart from anything else, David. So I'd like to go back to that book, which I found so fascinating. Also, you've managed to find lovely pictures, little black and white pictures, because you ended up working on the trains, didn't you, before your illustrious broadcasting and writing career?
Yes. Well, during it, actually, I took a pause after studying at Wits University, and I thought, because my father was a railwayman, and like many of them, he was a railwayman for 45 years. Most of them, they joined and they stayed. When he was growing up, there was the Depression, and to get a job, any job, was very, very important. And once you had that job, you stayed. You didn't move around as people did later. And, of course, your father and you grow old together. He then grows old and dies. And only later do you start wanting to ask him questions about what it was like when he was doing these things.
Yes.
And for example, he was an electrician. And he was an artisan, he apprentice and so on, joined the railways. And he would work on the overhead electrical equipment that drove the electric locomotives. Although a lot of steam locomotives around, there were electric ones too. And he worked on that equipment. He used to be called out in the middle of the night, and there would be snow on the Drakensberg, bitter, bitter cold.
Yes.
And they'd have to go out in the dark and work on these electrical lines. It was hard work, cold work and so on. But I never really took an interest in it. And now I wish I'd asked him more about what it was like and how they worked and so on. And it was tough. It was very military, the railways, the hierarchy, discipline and so on. So I missed that. And I thought, I'd like to experience something of the organization that my father spent his life working for. He was still alive when I did this. He was very disappointed in me.
That you joined the railways.
I qualified as a teacher, which was what he wanted.
Yes.
And I was the first person in my family to go to university. So this was great, you know, and he saw this as, you know, a vindication of all his hard work that his sons had now gone to university. And then I went back and joined the railways. He was very disappointed. But I worked on the dining cars, and this was a world in miniature. Earlier you talked about cruises.
Yes.
On a train with the dining car, it was like a sort of second-tier kind of cruise.
I know exactly what you
mean. You're shut off from the world.
Yes.
You're together with a certain number of people for the night, and who knows what may happen. You never know your luck on a train.
Right. I wondered if you were thinking that.
But you're moving, and you're going through the night.
Yes.
And you're traveling.
And if it's daytime and you're sitting in the dining car, there's nothing nicer than having an elegant lunch, watching the countryside slip by.
That's right. So I got on the inside of this, having traveled on the trains a lot as a child, and these four-course, five-course meals. Mm. I mean, you go into the dining car for dinner, and you'd have soup, and you'd have fish, and you'd have main course, often two meats, vegetables, and so on. You'd have dessert, fruit and cheese and biscuits and a port afterwards. Mm. This all in 45 minutes on beautiful linen tablecloths and beautiful linen napkins.
Yes.
And
lovely cutlery as well.
Solid heavy silver, which you had to polish every day. And the big dining cars on the Johannesburg-Durban or Johannesburg-Cape Town line, they would serve four or five sittings, 44 seats in the dining car, and they'd serve four or five sittings each around 45 minutes.
Good grief.
Taking 4 to 5 hours.
And remember, we need to remember, in that cramped kitchen of those coaches, the kitchen was cramped.
Tiny. And the food was prepared freshly. Mm-hmm. There were no cellophane-wrapped, pre-packed things.
Yes.
The food was prepared on that night, and it tasted like it. And look, it wasn't always perfect. Sometimes a bit cold. Sometimes, you know, the meat was a bit tough. But generally, it was an astonishing thing. And in those days, no one went to restaurants or takeaways. I mean, you might have a fish and chip shop down the road. But otherwise, you ate at home.
Yes.
But to travel on the train was like going into another world.
Yes.
Course after course after course. It was wonderful. So I got into that as it was beginning to decline. And people were beginning to desert the railways for the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw enough of it. And I saw some of these old guys who'd been there since the war. And they knew every inch of every line they traveled on. And there was one old chief steward. The chief steward was God, like the captain of a ship, like the chef in his kitchen. And we were on a day trip to Durban, and we were traveling back to Johannesburg. Not many passengers. And we were sitting in the dining car, moment to rest. And he was facing me with the train going. He was back to the engine.
Yeah,
and I was facing the way the train was going. So
right.
I could see the countryside coming towards me. And he said, suddenly he said, just look over there to the left. And I looked out of the window, and there was this beautiful waterfall. Substantial waterfall, which couldn't be seen from the road. There were no roads nearby. You could only see it from the train, and only for a few seconds.
Yes.
But he knew the track so well, and he wasn't watching what was coming, but he knew at a particular point that the waterfall was about to appear. He knew it so well.
Goodness me. That just shows the dedication as well, because just reading this book, I was struck by the sense of dedication that the people you lived with in those railway villages and their devotion to their jobs, no matter how menial.
A lot of them, I mean, if you take the steam engines, so there were some men who regarded this as demeaning work. It was the only work they could get. Hard work, shoveling tons of coal into the fire if you're the stoker, the fireman, and then the driver. You progressed, you became a fireman, and then you progressed and eventually became a driver. So some of them just regarded it as a job. But many saw it as a calling. They saw themselves as highly privileged.
Yes.
And I tell the story in the book of Billy Bester, who was the legendary driver of the train that went from Escort to Weenen. Now, if you know the Natal Midlands, those two towns are about 30 miles apart, 50 kilometers.
Yes.
And in the early years of the 20th century, they needed a railway, because there were no roads, to get the vegetables. It was a great vegetable growing area from Weenen to Escort, which got them to other places in the country. And Billy Bester grew up in Weenen, and he used to go down to the railway shed to help clean the engine out after the day's trip. And one day the old driver was there and crying. This old man was crying. And Billy Bester, the child, he said, "Wim, why are you crying? What's wrong?" And he said, "I'm retiring today. This is my last journey. I've just finished my last journey. I'm 65. I have to retire." And they were very strict about that. And you retired at the end of the month that you turned 65. And Billy Bester said, "If a man can cry about stopping his work, I want to do this work." Which he did. And he moved all over Natal as a fireman and as an engine driver. And eventually he got a posting back to Weenen, which was his dream job. And for 20 years, he drove that train.
the Weenen Escort one.
Yes. So these were men who loved what they did, most of them. They used to regard their engines as mistresses almost. They called them she.
That's right.
She, her, not it. And they would spend many hours unpaid polishing. the engines. And some of them did not want to be separated. They wanted their engine not to be moved around. So it was an extraordinary culture where, whether you were an engine driver or a conductor or a guard, they were very proud, generally, proud of what they did. Time was important. Earning money was important. Promotion was important. But there was a collective pride.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them worked their whole lives for the railways.
Yeah. It's interesting that you speak about shining the engines, because very often when you think of a steam engine, you think of the brass pipes glittering and the steel. I mean, which must have taken hours to do to get it to shine like that.
Many hours, and some of them would spend 2 or 3 hours a day just polishing.
Just polishing.
They didn't have to do that,
yes.
But there was a pride in it.
Yeah. I liked your chapter where you called On the Footplate, which has to do, doesn't it, with steam engines and your experience with a steam engine.
Well, the footplate, people say, what's the footplate?
Yes.
It's literally a plate of steel, which is the floor of the cab. So you've got the boiler in the front where the water is boiled. You've got the tender with the coal and the water behind, the food and drink of the engine.
Yes.
And, of course, the footplate is literally where the driver and the fireman stand on the footplate.
Mm-hmm.
And the culture around that, because this is two men who go out on their own. And if you think, like an airliner, they are traveling through the night. They have 400 passengers behind them, and everyone's sleeping. And these two men at the front are in charge of this train. And there's a trust in their expertise, in their ability, in their experience. And the footplate kind of is a term that has many connotations for that team of always two men out there doing it.
Yeah.
The pride in the work, the discipline of the work.
And that chapter was one of many in the book, by the way, David, I must say, that I so enjoyed. Now, we're going to have another music break, and I see Peter Dawson's name here.
Well, Peter Dawson, forgotten name now, but in the 20s and 30s, well, first 20 years, 30 years of the 20th century, but when recording became a big thing in the 20s and 30s, he was the most recorded artist in the world. And according to some discographies, as the musicologists say, he recorded more songs, more records than anyone else, even Elvis and Bing Crosby and people like that. Maybe that's not true, but a prolific recording artist. And he was the kind of the baritone of empire. He sang these music hall songs, the songs from the old 20s and 30s stage shows and so on. There was Old Man River he would sing, Old Father Thames, and he had this repertoire. A Bachelor Gay, which had a different connotation
then,
to what it might now. And my father, who was also a baritone, used to sing these songs at the piano on a Saturday evening when I was growing up. And one of the ones I loved the most, and I later came to appreciate as poetry, Rudyard Kipling's poem, On the Road to Mandalay. And Peter Dawson sings this, and I think he composed the music for Kipling's poem. And let's listen to it, and then when we come out of it, I'll tell you why I think this is so significant. But if you listen to this man's voice, and he was said to be an opera candidate, but he didn't want the rigor of opera. He wanted to be a popular singer, and he certainly was.
The old mine pagoda, looking eastward to the sea. There's a Burma girl a-setting, and I know she thinks of me. For the wind is in the palm trees, and the temple bells they say, come you back, you British soldier. Come you back to Mandalay, come you back to Mandalay, come you back to Mandalay, where the old flotilla lay. Can't you hear their paddles chunking from Rangoon to Mandalay? On the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play, and the dawn. comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. Ship me somewhere east of Suez, where the best is like the worst, where there ain't no Ten Commandments and a man can raise a thirst. For the temple bells are calling, and it's there that I would be, by the old mine pagoda, looking lazy at the sea, looking lazy at the sea. Come you back to Mandalay, where the old flotilla lay. Can't you hear their paddles chunking from Rangoon to Mandalay? On the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes lay, and the horn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay.
Quite a voice, Peter Dawson on the road to Mandalay. Another choice of my guest, David Williams, who seems to be a bit of a fan of Peter Dawson.
Yes, as I say, partly because my father used to sing. We had records, and my father used to sing, and I didn't realize how good my father was as a singer. Well, I would have thought so, but, you know, he was very good. But why I love this one in particular, if you go back to Madame Butterfly and The Lost. Now, in that song, On the Road to Mandalay, he says, there's a Burma girl a-sitting, and I know she thinks of me.
Oh.
Because he's saying, he's thinking of when he was as a soldier in Mandalay, Burma.
Yeah, yeah.
And now he's gone. He's gone back to England. And he says, when the wind is in the palm trees and the temple bells they call, then I think of her.
Oh, I see the connection.
And it's
now
almost that it's the working class Madame Butterfly.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. My goodness me.
It's loss, it's love and loss. And I'm not sure which one is more emotional, because I get quite emotional listening to both of them.
Yes,
sense of loss.
Yeah.
And he says that somewhere there's a Burma girl a-sitting.
Oh, God.
And he also talks there about there's no Ten Commandments and a man can raise a thirst. And he says in Mandalay, empire soldiers out there, I mean, what they must have got up to.
Yes.
Away from the restrictions of stuffy British society. So there's this longing for a life that he had. And there's this girl, and he says, I know she thinks of me. But he's not going back.
How romantic of you, David. Getting back to your book, On the Railway, The Great South African Train Story, one of your chapters, Taking the Train, when the aim of travel was not to arrive. And that chapter I found particularly enjoyable because there you were a young man, weren't you? And your family took the train to go on holiday.
Well, a young boy.
You did the whole experience.
Yes, a young boy the first time, and many times after that I chose to take the train whenever I could, to take as long as I could on the
train.
Yes, yes. The aim of travel is not to arrive. But the very first journey was so memorable. I can remember many of the details. Getting onto the coach at escort in the middle of the night, which was in itself exciting.
Yes.
And this old wooden coach with a balcony on each end. So when you were out there, you could get on the balcony and sniff the coal smoke. I think coal's had a very, very bad press lately as a pollutant. I love coal. I love coal smoke. And getting on this train and getting into the bed, the bunks that they made up with thick blue blankets, crisp white sheets, these soft pillows, not foam plastic pillows. They were soft feather-filled pillows. And you always got this bed when you got on the train. And I remember my first time as a little boy going to sleep with the rocking of the train and the sound of the wheels and seeing my father's trousers and jacket hanging from a hook next to the door, which slid open and closed, yeah. and swinging
right with the motion of the train.
As the train went and hearing this noise, there was no sound more comforting. And I remember feeling proud in a way that my father was part of this great enterprise where people could travel on the trains like this. And later on that night, I woke again, and we were somewhere in the Free State. And the electric locomotives that took it from Durban to Ladysmith, now replaced by steam engines, which I didn't realize. And I heard the sound of the steam engines that I'd woken every morning to, now at the front of the train.
It was a real working steam engine.
Through the night.
Yeah.
And at one point, the train turned the corner, and I could see the glow of the fire. And the fireman was feeding the locomotive. And I had the sense of these two men at the front of the train and this great orange furnace that was driving the train. And that was the only light you could see. All around was darkness. And behind it, this huge train.
Yeah,
it was a wonderful image.
It's beautifully written, David, may I say, in this book,
you
that
may.
Journey. You may. Those were the days as well of classes, weren't they? It was first class, second class, and then third class. And, I mean, one of your chapters is called Slech Blankers. Remember when apartheid kicked in really strong? And so it struck the railways particularly hard, didn't it?
Well, this is the dark side. I mean, I have many happy memories, and I think a lot of people have great memories of traveling by train. I would think a lot of those people are white because, as you say, first and second class were essentially for whites.
Yes, absolutely.
Third class was for blacks. And no white traveled third class. There were some coaches which were reserved for blacks or non-white people, as they said, first and second class. Mm-hmm. And in a funny nomenclature, those coaches were called reserved. So you had first class coach, number one on the side. Underneath would say reserved. Now, this meant it was reserved for non-white people, for black people. But a foreigner coming here might have thought this is for some cabinet minister special official. So there were weird divisions. But essentially third class, and the third class bunks were hard. Mm-hmm. The second class, there were six in a compartment, and they weren't very comfortable. First class was more comfortable, four bunks. So yes, there was that class division, which was inherited from England, but also it was a racial division. Mm-hmm. And the railways, I'm afraid, enforced apartheid fully and reflected the ruling National Party in particular when a lot of apartheid was kind of custom. And after 1948, it became codified and legislated. And it was rigid. I mean, there were stations, medium-sized stations, where there would be a subway and a bridge. And the one was for whites and the other one was for black. You didn't need both.
No, of course not.
There wasn't the traffic to justify two bridges or two subway, but they built both. The cost of this replication of services must have been enormous. And the social hurt, the lack of dignity. Mm-hmm. Johannesburg's Park Station, which is one of the great stations of the world at its peak, 16 platforms, very busy. And platforms one and two were the only ones for the suburban trains that went to Soweto. Third class, crammed with people, uncomfortable. And then the other platforms, lots of space for white people.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a dark aspect to it. The apartheid softened and was lifted in the 1980s. They couldn't maintain it anymore. But it was, as I say, the dark side of the railway experience.
And you said something very interesting as well with the launch, when I was at the launch of your book, where a lot of people blame the ANC for the collapse of our railway, which I think a lot of that is true. But you say it began during the National Party leadership.
Yes. So if you looked at the railways, they probably hit their peak in terms of route mileage as the national network in the late 1920s. Because until then, there was no national road network. Mm. Most things had to be carried by train, and most little towns had their railway station. So the country was actually linked together, that and radio. There were two things that linked the far-flung communities of South Africa, the railway and radio, made them feel part of a bigger entity. And they hit their peak in the 1920s. And for the next 30 years, 40 years, that network continued. And in the 1970s, the government released some of the restrictions on road travel and road carrying of goods. There were permits. They protected the railways for a long time. And the railways were pretty efficient at doing it. But they deregulated too quickly. And a lot of traffic, both human and goods, moved to the road. And suddenly, a lot of these railway lines were not carrying any goods. And some of the passenger trains were now carrying fresh air, as one senior executive put it. And they had to start downscaling. They had to start cancelling services. But the way they did it wasn't sort of sensible in the sense of what can we keep, what can we focus on. They simply cut costs, cut everything. And by the 1990s, when the ANC came in, there was great confusion because the National Party government kind of saw economic sense and they wanted to privatize. Eskom, Transnet, all, they were moving towards privatization. And that may well have saved large parts of the railways. And then that was reversed under the ANC. But they didn't say they were reversing it. They just kind of put a hold. So strategically, no one quite knew, including the railways, how they were supposed to plan and go for the future. And the decline continued. And then the state capture era kind of finished off the railways because then came a lot of corruption, bad procurement, inefficiencies, wrong people in the wrong jobs, a lot of money stolen from the system.
And then massive cable theft.
Cable theft, I mean, hundreds of kilometers of cable theft, signaling wires, overhead wires. The wires that my father worked, installed, worked to protect, eventually became an inspector of. Kilometers, stolen, gone, which means the trains can't run. And I think the criminals realized that no one was going to catch them. So this was done in broad daylight very often. And then COVID came. And the security company, that PRASA, the passenger rail agency, there was some issue and they stopped using this company but didn't appoint another one. There was no one guarding this vast infrastructure. So it was looted. And they're now trying to recover from this and it's going to be a long, difficult journey.
Let's have another piece of music, although this is a very sad piece of music. Nimrod from the Enigma Variations.
Well, maybe that's what we need is a sad piece of music at this point.
Yes. Of the story.
Of elegy for the railways. This was an interesting one for me, and I came to it relatively late. Elgar wasn't a known composer to me. My father, for some reason, being of Cornish origin, an Englishman, although born in South Africa, he didn't have much interest in English music. He liked the Italians and the Germans and so on, the popular stuff, and he sang some of it. So we weren't exposed to Elgar or Ray Vaughan Williams and so on. And this was the wrong way around for me. I heard this piece of music and I didn't know what it was on the radio. And I thought, what is that? What is that? It's so emotional. And I imagined a chest filling with air and emotion and breaking a person breaking down because the music seemed to swell emotionally. I thought, what is this? And I eventually tracked it down. And it was Elgar, Enigma Variations, and in particular the Nimrod section. So I sort of went into it backwards and discovered it. Yeah. And through that discovered Elgar, who I think that we don't hear enough of. Very emotional music, beautiful music. So it's partly a response to my musical upbringing, if you like, being in a family where there was music. But I like to think that it opened me to new music that I never heard when I was a little boy. But it opened me to new music like this.
That certainly is a remarkably beautiful piece of music. Melancholy and yet powerful. Nimrod from the Enigma Variations by Sir Edward Elgar, with Richard Koch there, who's a friend of yours as well, and the National Symphony Orchestra. My guest is David Willems. We've been talking about his book called On the Railway, The Great South African Train Story. And your last chapter, and we touched on this, your second last chapter was the Slech Blankers, Whites Only. And then Going Off the Rail is your last, The Rails is your last, Decline and Fall of a Great Railway System. And it was, wasn't it? It was internationally famous, wasn't it, our railway system?
Yes, and I referred earlier to some of the aspects of the decline. It was a great system. At its peak, it was something like 24,000 kilometers, which was more than the rest of Africa combined, and the 10th biggest railway system in the world. And in terms of innovation, it was astonishing. They had, for example, the first major railway electrification project in the world, where they electrified from Pietermaritzburg to Glencoe in Natal, because the gradients were so steep that the steam engines battled to get them up, and they needed electric locomotives, less romantic but more powerful. So there were things like that. They had managers and executives who would spend their lives, their whole lives on the railway, innovating, many of them, very, very good executives and leaders. And that kind of ethos began to disintegrate in the 1990s. They brought in business consultants, and my father told the story of something called GOM. GOM was goal-orientated management.
Oh, right.
And they called it GOM. So they brought in all these management concepts, and my father said, what is the goal of the engine driver? It's to get the train safely to the destination on time. Now, why must we now go into GOM, goal-orientated management?
But it's so true, isn't it?
So they lost traffic.
Yes.
Their responses were not right. So, but there was a combination of things. The theft, the lack of safety on trains, it reflected a broader breakdown in society, if you like.
Very much so.
The railways police were abolished and joined up with the South African police, which left whole areas of the railways unpoliced, both passengers and goods. All of these things accumulated. And there's no shortage of policy papers and strategies and PowerPoint presentations on what should be done. For the last 25 years, we've been hearing this. But government, which it still is, Transnet and PRASA, have proved incapable so far of doing it. And once you lose critical mass in a massive enterprise like Transnet or Eskom, you can't just spend some money and replace it, because skills have been lost, experience has been lost. Very difficult to restore.
But so then, as a final thought, David, is there any hope that it can be restored? We've lost the Transnatal Express, the
Transkaroo,
all those great trains where many families used for so many years to take their children on holidays, like yourself.
Yep.
Now they don't run anymore.
Well, there are two kinds of passenger rail. The one is commuter rail. So in Cape Town, there's the suburban trains.
Which is pulling itself together, but very slowly.
Yes, but they are beginning to restore it. In the old days, the trains in Cape Town used to be timed to the half minute. They were so quick and efficient. Johannesburg had a big metro rail component, Durban, Eastern Cape. Now they're beginning to restore that. But the long distance trains, Johannesburg, Cape Town, there are none. They've tried to run a few, and it's been a disaster, because the infrastructure to support these trains, catering, lighting, staffing, inspectors, all the things that go into running a train are not there anymore, and the skills have been lost, and it's very difficult just to recreate them.
Yes.
So it's a sad thing. You can, and think of the tourist potential. What could have been done with our long-distance trains?
I mean, this country is just made for long-distance train travel, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sitting, as I said earlier, in the dining car, having a magnificent meal and watching the beautiful country slide by.
Well, other countries are using Canada, Australia. They are building trains and building new routes using train tourism as an attraction. We have none.
Oh, dear. Well, we're going to have to end on a slightly sad note in that case because of your last chapter. So I just want to say, David, thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed this book. It's well worth a read and filled in so many gaps as well. And with, as you say, with the lovely pictures you've got. And I want to end with a quote from Edwin Cameron, Justice Edwin Cameron, who wrote your foreword. I doubt anyone other than David could have written On the Railway with its lavish blend of history, analysis, information, anecdote, insight, and reflection. Isn't that a lovely thing to say? And I agree with every one of those words. So I must say congratulations, David. Mm. And your music to leave the studio is George Gershwin.
Well, let's stay emotional.
Okay.
All of the pop pieces I've chosen mean a lot to me emotionally.
Emotionally, yes, yes, yes.
In my background, growing up, later discovery, get emotional when I hear those that music. And one of the great emotional scenes for me, which is both dance and singing, opera, depending on who's doing it, is An American in Paris by George Gershwin. Mm. I think George Gershwin is fantastic. Rhapsody in Blue is one of the all-time great pieces of music. But An American in Paris, and there's a clip, and people must Google it and find it on YouTube, of Gene Kelly, a great dancer, who was a very masculine but very sensitive dancer, and Leslie Caron, who had the best legs in the world. And they danced together to the music of An American in Paris, and it is so moving. It makes you want to cry, the beauty of it, and the attraction between them. It's glorious.
Well, let's leave it there as we think sadly of our train service and the great train services in the world. Let's go on the Orient Express or the one to Vladivostok. Let's do something. But David Williams, thank you very much. The book is published by Tafelberg. It's called On the Railway, The Great South African Train Story. And I was talking to the author, David Williams. David, thank you.
Thank you, Rodney. Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.